We are jumping right into a story today for this deep dive that hinges on a pretty mind-bending historical coincidence. So picture this. The year is 1710. The British governor of New York, this guy named Robert Hunter, has just imported a massive colony of refugees to the Hudson Valley.
Right, and he brought them over for an incredibly ambitious industrial scheme.
Exactly. An industrial scheme that is, spoiler alert, going to fail completely. But right in the middle of orchestrating this totally doomed colonial project, Governor Hunter sits down and personally signs a legal document. It's a printing apprenticeship for a 12-year-old orphaned refugee in that very group, a boy named John Peter Zenger.
Oh, wow. Okay. For anyone who follows American legal history, hearing the name John Peter Zenger just set off some massive alarm bells.
Yeah, you probably recognize the name from, high school history classes. Because 25 years after that apprenticeship gets signed, that orphaned kid is running his own print shop down in New York.
Right, and he ends up getting put on trial for something called seditious libel after criticizing the royal governor.
Yeah, and his 1735 acquittal basically invents the whole concept of American press freedom, which is just wild.
It is wild, and it's probably worth pausing to just quickly define that. Because seditious libel in the 18th century didn't mean you printed a lie. It actually meant it was a criminal offense to criticize the government at all, even if, every single word you printed was completely true.
Truth was not a defense.
Exactly. Truth was no defense whatsoever. But the Zenger trial flipped that completely on its head. His lawyer successfully argued that if the criticism is factual, it cannot be libel. And that single moment is the absolute seed of the First Amendment.
And he was only there because of this totally failed industrial project. I mean, you know how in the tech world there's this running joke where a massive software bug accidentally becomes like the most popular feature of the whole operating
Oh,
system?
yeah, totally. Where the software completely fails at what it was programmed to do, but inadvertently creates something world-changing.
Exactly. Well, today we are exploring an editorial piece from Destination Hudson Valley's The Edit, and it turns out colonial history has its own ultimate version of that glitch. We're focusing on a quiet riverside hamlet called West Camp up in Saugerties, New York.
Right, and to really understand how John Peter Zenger and thousands of these German-speaking refugees ended up on the Hudson River to begin with, we kind of have to look at the brutal logistics that put them there.
We do. And to unpack those logistics, we need to roll the clock back a bit, right? To the winter of 1708 and 1709.
Yeah, we have to start there because this wasn't, a voluntary relocation where people were just seeking a new life. This was a massive, really desperate refugee crisis. The story begins in the Rhineland-Palatinate, which is a German-speaking territory right along the Rhine River.
And for context here, that entire region had basically just been pulverized by the War of the Spanish Succession.
Precisely, which was essentially this decade-long European proxy war over who gets to sit on the Spanish throne. And the Rhineland happened to be the geographic doormat that everyone's armies just kept wiping their boots on.
Right, so you've got French armies, British armies, Dutch armies, they all just march through, burning crops, seizing livestock, destroying towns.
Exactly. So the population is already totally exhausted and starving. But then comes the winter of 1708 to 1709, and this is recorded as one of the absolute coldest winters in European memory. We're talking about like birds freezing in midair and falling to the ground.
Oh my gosh, that is terrifying.
It was. The Rhine River actually froze solid, so that winter essentially finished whatever the war had started. Famine, freezing conditions, just total devastation. So tens of thousands of these people, who are known as Palatines, they flee down the frozen
It
river.
was desperate to survive.
Pure desperation. And they head for England because rumor has it that Queen Anne's government is going to offer sanctuary to fellow Protestants.
Okay, let's talk about the scale of this for a second. Because arriving in London in 1709 as a refugee meant basically stepping into chaos. The sources note that by the summer, there were roughly 13,000 destitute Palatine refugees just living in army tents on the outskirts of London.
13,000 traumatized people suddenly appearing in an 18th century city. I mean, London was completely overwhelmed. There was absolutely no sanitation infrastructure for them, no long-term housing plan.
Right.
And frankly, the local political appetite to keep them there just vanished almost immediately. So the British government defaulted to the standard imperial solution to a crisis, move the problem somewhere else.
Wait, hold on. I have to challenge this framing a bit because a transatlantic voyage in 1710 for thousands of starving people, that does not sound like a convenient way to just sweep a problem under the rug.
No, not at all.
I mean, that sounds like an incredibly complex, expensive logistical nightmare. Why would the crown take on the massive financial burden of shipping these people across the ocean just to be charitable?
Well, they wouldn't. And they didn't. You're hitting on the exact shift in the story here. The Crown was not looking at this as a humanitarian rescue mission. They were looking at 13,000 people and seeing a sudden surplus of cheap labor.
Ah, okay.
So Queen Anne's government loaded roughly 3,000 of these refugees onto a fleet of 10 ships, put them under the authority of Robert Hunter, who was the newly appointed governor of New York, and sent them across the ocean.
But sent them under strict contracts of indentured servitude. So they were essentially trading one nightmare for another. It sounds like the Crown was treating this humanitarian crisis purely like an inventory problem on a ledger.
Exactly like an inventory problem.
Like Warehouse A in London is overflowing. Let's box this labor force up and move them to Warehouse B across the Atlantic to put them to work.
A very grim ledger, yeah. And the crossing itself took 6 months.
Yeah.
To put that in perspective for you. A modern cruise ship crosses the Atlantic in about a week.
Yeah.
6 months in the hull of an 18th century ship meant cramped, lightless conditions, surviving on rotting rations.
And diseases, right.
Rampant spread of shipboard diseases, especially typhus. Out of the 3,000 who boarded in London, roughly 470 people died on the voyage.
Wow. And arriving in New York Harbor wasn't even the end of the nightmare for them. I mean, they couldn't even disembark into the city.
No, the dying just continued. The fleet dropped anchor. But because of the typhus, or Palatine fever, as the locals called it, the survivors were forced into quarantine on Nutton Island, which we now know as Governor's Island.
Right, in the harbor.
Right. And they stayed in these crude tents on that island for months until the fevers finally burned out.
It is just an agonizing start, and yet this traumatized group of survivors represents the largest single demographic block of immigrants to enter British America before the Revolution. So what was this massive labor force actually brought there to do?
Well, they were brought there to break a global monopoly. The Crown had a very specific corporate agenda here. At that time, the Royal Navy practically ran on tar and pitch. You need immense quantities of it to waterproof the wooden ship hulls, seal the ropes, preserve all the rigging.
Because without tar, wooden ships rot and you literally no longer have a navy.
Exactly. But Britain was buying nearly all of its tar from Sweden and the Baltic region.
Which means the most powerful navy in the world was totally at the mercy of Baltic politics. And really, whatever prices Sweden felt like charging them.
It was a massive strategic vulnerability. So the Crown's grand scheme was to settle these Palatine refugees up in the Hudson Valley to tap the vast pine forests. The goal was to render that pine sap into pitch and tar and single-handedly free the Royal Navy from its dependence on Scandinavia.
So they secured roughly 12,000 acres on both banks of the Hudson River to act as this massive naval stores factory. They divided the settlers to cover more ground.
Right, east and west.
Yeah, the sources highlight East Camp on the east bank, which is now Germantown in Columbia County, and West Camp, which is on the west bank in Saugerties. And nearly 1,800 people were living in these two camps by the spring of 1711, all indentured to manufacture tar for a navy 3,000 miles away.
It was a highly orchestrated colonial industrial operation. And it collapsed entirely within 2 years.
The reason it fails is what really gets me, though. I mean, it isn't a rebellion or a natural disaster. The entire naval store scheme came undone because of a catastrophic administrative oversight. They were tapping the wrong kind of pine tree.
Yeah, it's almost comical in a really tragic way. The science of making tar in the 18th century was actually quite precise. And the planters completely ignored it. You don't just, you know, tap a pine tree the way you tap a maple tree for syrup and wait for a bucket to fill up.
Right, it's way more involved.
Much more. You have to carefully strip the bark over a period of years to force the tree to overproduce resin. Then you chop the wood, stack it in a massive earthen kiln, and burn it really slowly so the resin melts out and pools at the bottom.
And that process requires a very specific raw material. The Hudson Valley is full of eastern white pines. White pines simply do not produce enough resin to make naval-grade pitch. You need pitch pines for that.
Yep. Wrong trees entirely.
Plus, the specific bark stripping method that the British supervisors imported from the Baltics actually killed the white pines before they could even harvest the wood for the kilns.
The output was completely useless. So thousands of people moved across an ocean, hundreds dead, massive camps built in the wilderness, and nobody at the top bothered to check if the local flora was actually compatible with their manufacturing process.
Supreme arrogance. Just incredible.
Truly. So by September 1712, the operation just grinds to a halt. The project is dead.
And Governor Hunter, who had been fronting a massive amount of his own personal money to keep these camps running, he goes completely broke because London realizes the tar is useless and they refuse to reimburse him. So he basically throws his hands up, cuts his losses, and releases the Palatines from their indentures.
And this moment, the cutting of those indentures in 1712, is the absolute pivot of the entire narrative in the edits piece. This is where the story shifts from being about a failed industrial output to being about a lasting human legacy.
Oh, definitely.
Because a migration of thousands of people, organized by a government for one highly specific industrial purpose, is suddenly entirely free of that purpose. The planners never accounted for what would happen if the project failed, but the people remained.
Right. So without the legal contracts binding them to those specific riverbanks in West and East Camp, they began to move. The sources detail how, in the bitter winter of 1712 to 1713, Palatine representatives literally walked west through the snow.
And they didn't go to the colonial authorities in Albany to ask for new land either.
No. They bypassed the British entirely and approached the Mohawk clan mothers.
Which is a detail that speaks volumes about the reality of power on the frontier at that time. The Haudenosaunee, or the Iroquois Confederacy, is a matrilineal society. The Mohawk clan mothers held the ultimate authority over land use and settlement permissions.
So these freezing, stranded German refugees recognized who actually controlled the region.
Exactly. They negotiated directly with indigenous leadership. The clan mothers granted them permission to settle further inland, out in the Sukaheri Valley.
And by the spring of 1713, families were pulling up stakes in the camps and making that brutal overland trek to the Schoharie. From there, they spread even further into the Mohawk Valley.
And some even pushed down into Pennsylvania. Johann Conrad Weiser led a group down there in 1723. His son Conrad Weiser, who grew up living among the Mohawks and spoke the language fluently, he actually became colonial America's most crucial diplomat to the Six Nations.
Wow!
Yeah, this single dispersion completely changed the demographic makeup of the frontier.
I mean, the genealogy of the Hudson and Mohawk Valleys for the next three centuries is totally defined by the surnames seeded by this specific 1710 arrival. Names like Weiser, Herkimer, Zimmerman, and Frolic. They became the entire German-American backbone of the region.
Which really raises the central editorial argument of the piece we're examining today.
Right.
There is a profound philosophical difference between a project and a migration.
Oh, I love how they frame this.
Yeah, it's really smart. A project has an output. It either produces the thing it was designed to make, or it doesn't. And measured strictly by the ledger of the tar project, this venture was a total failure. It came up completely empty. If history only cared about projects, the story of these refugees would end right there in 1712.
Right. But a migration operates on a completely different metric. A migration produces people in a place.
Exactly. People in a place.
That phrasing perfectly captures the shift.
It does, because people in a place produce everything that comes after. They build congregations, they establish towns, raise new generations, and they weave a completely new cultural fabric into the landscape. The tar operation ended in 2 years. The migration founded an entire region.
Which brings us back to the 12-year-old boy we talked about at the very beginning of this deep dive, John Peter Zenger. How does a kid freezing in a defunct tar camp on the Hudson River end up in a New York City courtroom defending the freedom of the press?
Well, when the tar project was clearly failing, Governor Hunter had to figure out what to do with the most vulnerable refugees, particularly the orphans. Zenger's father had actually died on that horrific voyage over.
That's so sad.
It is. So in 1711, Governor Hunter indentured young John Peter to a man named William Bradford. And Bradford happened to be the only printer in New York City at the time.
So the governor who orchestrated the failed tar camps essentially handed this refugee child the exact tools he would later use to challenge colonial authority.
The irony is amazing, isn't it?
It really is. Zenger learns the printing trade from Bradford, eventually sets up his own press, and starts publishing the New York Weekly Journal, which routinely just dragged the subsequent corrupt royal governor through the mud.
Right, which led to his arrest for seditious libel, his landmark trial, and then the jury's shocking decision to acquit him because his criticisms were based in fact. The very foundations of American journalism were laid by a displaced orphan from a failed industrial scheme.
Now, While Zanger went south to the city, and families like the Weisers walked west to the Schoharie Valley, we really can't forget the original landing spot on the west bank of the Hudson. The people who stayed behind in West Camp created a physical anchor that is still there today.
Yeah, you're referring to St. Paul's Evangelical Lutheran Church, historically known as the Old West Camp Church.
Yes, exactly. The congregation was founded by Reverend Joshua de Coquerthal. He had actually led a much smaller, earlier group of Palatines to New York back in 1708 before the massive freeze.
Oh, right.
Yeah, he then returned to London and came back across the Atlantic with the massive 1710 fleet. He was their spiritual leader, just navigating all that trauma, the voyage, the typhus, and the failed tree tapping right alongside them.
And the records show that the first service on that land in West Camp was held on June 3, 1711. It's recognized as the oldest religious society in the town of Saugerties and among the oldest continuous Lutheran congregations in all of America.
The continuity is what is so striking to me. If you visit West Camp today, the church building you see dates to 1871. But over the centuries, they built an original log church, which was later replaced by a frame church in 1732 that they actually shared with the local Dutch Reformed congregation.
Right, right.
And then came the 1871 structure. But through all those architectural changes, the congregation has been meeting on that exact same ground for 315 years.
That is an unbroken institutional chain. In 1898, the community actually reinterred the remains of several early Palatines at the church, marking their presence right in the entryway. And then a century later, in 1998, they dedicated a Palatine monument on the lawn to explicitly honor the refugees of that 1709 and 1710 crisis.
There is just a deeper lesson here about how history actually survives. Continuity isn't held by wooden buildings. Buildings rot, they burn down, or they get replaced because a congregation grows or, you know, styles change. Continuity is held by institutions and societies.
That's a great way to look at it.
The human habit of gathering the community that keeps choosing to rebuild the structure on the same piece of earth that is what survives. The institution is the true inheritance, not the lumber.
And you really can't properly frame that inheritance at West Camp without acknowledging its sibling across the river, East Camp.
Which evolved into Germantown.
Exactly. Germantown was the matched half of the 1710 settlement. During the spring census of 1711, they were actually the larger of the two sides, living across four distinct villages on land they purchased from the Livingston family. East and West Camp are really two banks of a single migration.
They really are.
It's the same displaced people, the same brutal winter, the same horrific voyage, the same failed tar scheme, and ultimately the same survival. The British government wanted a naval factory. What it got instead was three centuries of continuous valley life.
The reason a place is founded is so rarely the reason it actually matters. West Camp was founded to extract tar from the wrong species of pine trees. But it matters because of the displaced people who were dropped on that shoreline to do the work. It matters because it accidentally seeded a culture, a community, and a boy who would grow up to champion the free press.
Yeah, displacement reads very differently when you look back at it from a three-century remove. In 1710, it was a story of pure desperation and a failed industrial ledger. Today, it reads as the foundational chapter of a massive cultural heritage. The town, the community, the legacy that is always what remains after the initial purpose ends.
So as we wrap up this dive into the origins of West Camp, here's a thought for you to take with you. The Hudson Valley, and really so much of the landscape around us, is deeply layered with these kinds of foundings. Places built for extractive purposes that have long since vanished.
Yeah, they're everywhere once you start looking.
Exactly. So the next time you are driving through your own region and you pass by an old mill town where the mill has been gone for 50 years, or a faded quarry filled with water, or a defunct riverside port, look past the empty buildings. Ask yourself, what was this place originally built to extract? And more importantly, what beautiful, completely unintended human migration did it accidentally leave behind instead?